This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. Brain death is the irreversible end of brain activity. It shouldn't be confused with persistent vegetative state, but it's much easier to define what brain death isn't than because there's so much confusion, even among experts and jurisdictions, about what it actually is. And unfortunately, this is not just an academic question. There are high-profile stories in the news right now that remind us that families are thrust into the middle of these complex questions, and religious beliefs play a major role in this, and there's legally complicated questions and political interest right in the middle of this very personal family issue. And we want to hear what you think. Give us a call about brain death. The number is 210-614-8980, 614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're going to spend our full hour talking about this issue. We definitely want to hear what you have to say. And we're joined by Jason Morrow. He is a medical ethicist and a palliative physician at the UT Health Science Center. And we're also joined by a neurointensivist, Rachel Garvin, also from the UT Health Science Center. Welcome, both of y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rachel, tell me, I'm not familiar with what a neurointensivist is. Tell me what that is.
Sure. So neurointensivists, they are critical care specialists who provide specialized ICU care for patients that have injury or disease or disorders of the central nervous system. So they have specialized training of 2 years after their generalized residency training in medicine to take care of these patients in an ICU setting.
So you've dealt with a lot of people who are in, these vegetative states and minimal consciousness?
That's correct.
And so, Jason, you've been on here many times before. Welcome back. Appreciate this. And as a palliative care physician, just tell us again what that is.
Palliative care is an area of medicine and nursing that focuses on symptom management, especially related to advanced illness. I see a lot of people with cancer, brain injury, renal failure, liver failure, emphysema. It's also not just symptom management, but help with tough decisions. We help guide families work through difficult decisions related to surgery, chemotherapy, dialysis, admission to the ICU. That often involves meeting with a patient's doctors and their specialists, such as Dr. Garvin, and eliciting a patient's and family's values and trying to help them make decisions about which medical treatments are best for them, as well as getting resources. We offer emotional and spiritual support. We refer people to nursing homes, rehabilitation, hospice, whatever it takes to help a family get what they need. So we do symptom support, help with tough decisions, and access to resources.
Dr. Garvin, let me ask you, this is a very complicated case. This has been in the news. Reminds us of that Terry Schiavo, Florida case that was in the news. When was that? About 10 years ago or so?
Somewhere around there.
And now the Terry Schiavo Foundation is involved in being an advocate for the people who are brain dead. And so this has become a political issue. But is being brain dead the same as being dead?
So when we pronounce somebody as brain dead, that is the same, the definition of death. So there are two ways that we can say that somebody is dead: that they have complete cessation of cardiac and respiratory function, or they have complete cessation of total brain function, meaning both the cerebral hemispheres and the brainstem. So if a patient were to fit either of those categories, no circulatory respiratory function or complete cessation of brain function, that is considered the definition of death.
So even in a legal sense, even state to state, when you say if a person is brain dead, then that person is considered dead, although there might be some questions about what you consider to be brain dead. But Jason, as a palliative care physician, do y'all consider brain dead the same as being dead?
Well, we do. I'm particularly sensitive, though, to the experiences and understandings that families have when trying to understand what brain death is. The general public is used to understanding death as fairly black or white. You're either pregnant or not. You're either dead or not. However, the history of understanding death is somewhat convoluted. If you think about prior to the 20th century, historically, the definition of death is, just as Dr. Garvin said, either apnea, not breathing, or asystole, the cessation of the heartbeat. And this is something that is built into our cultural understanding of death. We wait for someone to show those signs before we consider them dead. However, with the advent of life support and other technology in the 20th century, we had to rely on other definitions of death precisely because we have technology that supports the heart and lung function even when other parts of the body have stopped working. So I'm reminded of the French physiologists in the 1950s who were studying patients who were dwelling in institutions and were simply alive by virtue of these new respirators that had been invented. They used a term called coma dépassé, so a state beyond coma. Completely unresponsive, no signs of brain function beyond the body being alive, as evidenced by the working of the machine. This prompted an evaluation by a group of scholars at Harvard in the 1960s who put together a paper on the definition of death. And in that paper, the Harvard group articulated what's called the whole brain criteria of death, which is to say that if someone's cerebral cortex, the thinking portion of the brain, is not working, that may or may not be a quality of life that that person would want. But it is not dead in the sense that we have historically understood. The whole brain has to stop working. And if you think about it, there's some sense to that. The brain stem has within it the centers that will control, if you don't control it voluntarily, say your breathing, which you can control through your cerebral cortex. If the brain stem stops working, the rest of the body stops working. And it was in the early 1980s that the President's Commission supported a similar view, saying that brain death could be, exactly as Dr. Garvin said, either cessation of the entire function of the brain or cessation of the heart and lungs. This led to the Uniform Determination of Death Act, which has been accepted in all states. So every state will have within its health code an acceptance and endorsement of these two ways of defining death.
And the cases that are now in the news, the McMath case and the Munoz case, the family Munoz being in Texas, are these, do you know, can we tell if these people are brain dead, if there's no activity? Dr. Garvin.
Yeah, so, I mean, from going over these cases from what's in the news, it sounds like in both these cases that tests were done to determine brain death. And when brain death is determined, it's not something that's taken very lightly. So there are recommendations for how brain death exams are done, and they're done very systematically. And there are certain things that have to be looked for when patients are pronounced brain dead. You have to look for the patient to be not responsive to any stimuli at all. You have to look for the function of the brain stem and have to look to see if the patient has any evidence of stimulation to breathing. And it sounds like this is what was done in those cases to determine to brain death is a clinical exam. So from what's in the media about this, it sounds like that's what was done to determine that those patients were brain dead.
We're talking about brain death. There's two big cases in the news right now. People are interested. This is something that happens to families, and I guess society needs to come to terms with what is brain death. And we want to hear from you. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about two high-profile cases that are in the news right now, very complicated, dealing with brain death. What is brain death? These two cases, the patients, their brains are no longer showing activity, but it's controversial on whether or not they should be allowed to be taken off of machines and allow their body to die as well. With me to talk about that, we've got Jason Morrow. He is a palliative care physician from the UT Health Science Center. And we have Dr. Rachel Garvin. She is a neurointensive doctor, right? Is that right?
Neurointensivist, correct.
Neurointensivist. I missed the syllable there. Also from UT Health Science Center. So let me ask you, Rachel, what is the difference between brain dead and vegetative state?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's something that people don't have a good grasp on, and with good reason, because we can kind of look at this as consciousness as a spectrum. And so there's a spectrum from all of us sitting here and being awake and interactive and aware of our surroundings and aware of ourselves. And so if you look at the other end of the spectrum of brain death, when there's no function of the brainstem or the cerebral cortices or what does the higher level brain functions, you move one step down from that into coma. And so coma is when people are unresponsive to any stimuli. So they're not brain dead, but if I were to pinch them or shout their name, they wouldn't open their eyes. They would have no arousal and no awareness. And so that's when we define coma. And people don't usually stay in a coma for long periods of time. They usually transition to another state, either transition to brain death or transition to a vegetative state. And so a vegetative state is when patients have ability to have arousal but not awareness. So patients with a vegetated state can have eye opening, but they don't look around. They don't respond as people do when they're aware of their surroundings. They can have evidence of sleep-wake cycles, as we see on EEG, which looks at brain waves, but they don't have any awareness of their surroundings or themselves.
And so when you say arousal, that may be in the normal street language of people, that it just means being responsive, being able to react to things.
So they may, a patient who's in a vegetative state may open their eyes and they may seem like they're looking around, but if you were to ask, call their name, they may not look at you and be able to track your movements across the room. So the activating system in the brain that allows them to be awake may be functioning, which is in the brainstem, but they don't have that higher functioning of being able to track, follow commands, and respond appropriately. And then you move over from that one other step to what's called the minimally conscious state. And these are patients who not only have times of being of arousal, of being able to open eyes and seem to be responsive, but they also have awareness. So these are patients that may intermittently follow commands. They may laugh at times that are appropriate or cry, but don't have that sustained level of interaction that someone with normal brain function has.
And so when you're in a coma or meditatively aware state, conscious state, that's not considered brain dead. They're not dead.
That's correct. So any of these states from coma, vegetative state, and minimally conscious state, these all are all states where the brain is functioning. It is a spectrum of how much function is going on. But there is blood flow to the brain. There is functioning of the brain.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Our phone lines are open. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. And Dr. Cardi has called in. Dr. Cardi, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you. And having taken care of in an ICU setting, many patients who were waiting for organ procurement, both because their families were, because of severe brain injury, had elected that when they were ready for procurement, they would take them off of life support, but also dealt with patients who were truly brain dead in the whole brain, kind of definition. I suspect that the two cases in question, the patients are actually not brain dead. The patients with whole brain death were always extremely difficult to keep alive, even for 12 hours, maybe a day or two, until organ procurement services could arrive, whereas those that were in a vegetative state, had severe brain injuries, had complete loss of cortical brain function, could stay alive potentially for years. And if I'm just suspicious that the incorrect terms are being passed around, perhaps even from the doctors involved, if these patients have been alive for now several weeks after their offending injuries.
It's very difficult, according to your experience as a doctor, that you've seen, it's very difficult to keep patients who are brain dead actually alive, even on with the help of all these machines like respirators and everything else. And so you're suspicious of actually calling these cases that we're seeing in the news brain dead because they've been on for like 7 or so weeks, right?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. All right, so let's get a response to that from Dr. Garvin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I mean, most patients, when they are pronounced brain dead, are not usually left on artificial ventilation and support for extended amounts of time. And I think it oftentimes depend on what was the situation that led to the patient becoming brain dead. Oftentimes, patients become very unstable if they have a significant amount of brain swelling that happens quickly and causes a herniation syndrome, meaning that the brain swells and causes pushing down on the vital structures, which causes a lot of instability of the heart and the lungs. And that's often what we see when patients have a severe injury. We can only gather from what is said in the news about these patients are being brain dead, but especially the details that have been noted about the case in California is that the patient, the 13-year-old, had numerous brain death exams. And most states have, based on the guidelines by the American Academy of Neurology of how a brain death exam is done from a clinical standpoint and with ancillary studies. And if those are done correctly, then there's very little times that there are false positives with that. And people who are pronounced brain dead, there's really no cases of patients having reversal of that function, which the American Academy of Neurology has looked into several times when the guidelines have been revamped. So I think it's a good point that, yes, there are often patients that are very unstable, but there are often patients, once they progress to brain death and they are controlled in terms of the problems you have with certain organ systems, if those are managed, then those patients can be sustained for several days. I'm not in the practice of sustaining patients for weeks on artificial support, so I can't comment on that from personal experience, but we've had many patients that we've kept on support for days, either waiting for that because they are donors or because we're waiting for family to come into town and say their goodbyes. And oftentimes, with adequate support, they remain relatively stable.
So let's talk about the organ donors. Typically, that's where we get many of our organs from people who have suffered brain death, right? Because then it allows the being able to get the organs and keep them going until we can find a suitable transplant. Isn't that right?
Well, that's true. The vast majority of organ donors are people who are dead, even at the time of everybody's dead at the time of donating organs. In fact, there's the dead donor rule, which is not exactly codified into state or national law, but it's a common law that's been recognized and endorsed through multiple professional groups and other state legislatures. However, you bring up the interesting case of something called donation after circulatory death. And This is not a brand new technology. It's actually the way organ donation was practiced back in the 60s. Things changed and it sort of lost favor, and now it's becoming an increasing portion. So when you think about somebody who dies in a motorcycle crash and then their organs are later donated, that's an uncontrolled death. Donation after circulatory death is what I might call a controlled death. And this is a situation where somebody comes into the hospital oftentimes with a severe brain injury, whether traumatic or lack of blood flow. I suspect that Jehai McMath in California and Marlise Munoz in Dallas both were cases of anoxic or lack of oxygen to the brain, sorts of brain death. Now, in the intensive care unit, say somebody comes in with a severe brain injury, but their whole brain is not dead. It may be understood that the patient wants to be an organ donor and would not want to live on life support for the short or long term with that kind of brain injury wherein there is this really very poor prognosis. In that setting, what you can do is arrange for life support to be removed in a controlled setting, that is, in the operating room. If, in fact, the patient's heart and lungs stop after removal of life support, and after waiting an appropriate time, there have been no cases of hearts restarting on their own after 90 seconds. So typically, in these controlled settings, the physicians in the room will wait 2 to 5 minutes, depending on institutional protocol, before retrieving and donating organs. Of course, the patient in that situation is dead by virtue of having no heart and lung function, but not the entire function of their brain has been determined to be lost. So I think the case of Jehai McMath and Carlise Munoz, we have to rely on what we have in the media, that somebody appropriately determined that the whole brain was dead, either by looking at the lack of blood flow to the brain. If you do an MRI that looks at blood vessels and there's no blood flow to the brain isn't working, the entire brain. And there are other tests that are equally reliable that physicians can use. But you don't always have to have whole brain death for a person to be an organ donor.
All right, we're going to go to the phones. The number is 614-8980, and Darlena has called in. Darlena, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. My comment is, as a layman, that it's hard to understand the concept because the medical professionals do not hesitate to call a cardiac death, but they call it brain death, so they themselves appear concerned about using the straight term death. So how do we understand that?
All right. Thank you for that phone call, Darlene. Appreciate it. Good question. So, Dr. Morrow, is it you know, brain dead, dead.
Well, I think this caller has an excellent point. And to be clear, I think into the distant future, we're still going to have ambiguities and misgivings about how to define death. You know, the medical profession has been around for a couple of millennia, but only in the last century have we had technology and interventions and diagnostic tools that are particularly helpful. We have to be patient, and I think we have to tolerate some ambiguity in defining death. Yes, when somebody says brain death, they are hedging, but that's because we're still grappling with our understandings. And I think there are two general concepts here that are at play. One is quality of life. I think that the informed consent movement in the 20th century and the movement that has advocated for a right to withhold technology to allow people to die in certain circumstances has traded on an understanding about self-determination, autonomy, that people have a right to determine what is done with their body, and they can make that decision based on what they can perceive to be a certain level of quality of life. The other part is prognosis. It's not just the quality of life, but prognosis. And the question is, for people who sustain a significant brain injury, will they ever recover? In the case of coma that Dr. Garvin mentioned, the prognosis is indeterminate. Many people will recover. You have to wait for signs that tell you the prognosis is irreversible. And I think those two elements should be talked about in any situation when discussing whether or not a person has brain death.
Also in the Dallas case, the Texas case, there is the issue of the woman is pregnant. And so we're going to have to talk about that when we come back from the news break. That's going to be a while. This is The Source on KSTX. We're talking about brain death and what our understanding of brain death. And if you get a call, give us a call. The number is 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The Source right now, we're discussing death, specifically brain death, and the efforts of some folks who want to eliminate whole brain death as a legal standard for death in America, centering on two high-profile cases, Jihai McMath and Marlise Munoz, in which brain-dead bodies are being kept alive by machines, and long after total irreversible loss of brain functions have been established. And with us to discuss this, we have Jason Morrow. He is a medical ethicist and a palliative physician at the University of Texas Health Science Center. And also we have neurointensivist Dr. Rachel Garvin, also from the UT Health Science Center. And we've been talking for a half hour now. We're continuing the conversation. And this has just been it's a sad topic. You know, we're talking about death. We can't get around it. This is death, but brain death is some people are trying to make it seem like that is that there's a workaround. But one thing that came up is that the insurance, according to the insurers, private insurers, and this is the way it's been for quite some time, that brain dead is dead, and they're not going to pay for care in that area. And so, Jason, how does that impact what's happening here?
Well, unfortunately, it matters. My opinion is that it maybe matters a little too much. In the case of Jihai McMath, and again, I'm basing my information on what the listening public is basing their information on. We're using the media. And what we understand, what I understand, is that Jihai was declared brain dead in the setting of a post-operative complication from a routine surgery. And I think that context is important to remember, that early December, Jahai's family was hoping that her surgery would go well.
It was,
and
she was just going in for a tonsillectomy.
Tonsil surgery related to
an
apnea syndrome.
Kid.
That's right. So one day she's healthy and going through surgery, and I'm sure the family had the ordinary fears and anxiety that they have about their kid going through surgery. And the next day the doctors are saying, you know, she suffered complications. As I understand it, she lost blood, and she was attempted to be resuscitated. This didn't work. She, other than to keep her heart and lungs alive, unfortunately, her brain had starved of oxygen. At the time that the doctors initially declared that her entire brain was not working, they then were on a path. And to secure the diagnosis of brain death, you have to wait some period, and this is usually determined by the state, as Dr. Garvin points out. And they brought in a specialist. They actually brought in a second specialist that was recommended by the court. And this specialist apparently endorsed the diagnosis. At that point, the hospital was correct in saying that the patient was dead, and any further care provided to Jihai McMath, her body, however you want to describe it, is not reimbursable. So if ICU care costs about $5,000 a day, then either the insurance company is expected to pay for it, and you're right, David, they will not, and insurance companies are very clear about that, or the taxpaying public will pay for it. Or a third alternative is that the family will. And in the context of strife, of grief, it's very difficult to talk about money. My opinion is that the hospital should not sweat that kind of money. The hospital should accommodate the needs of the family. And I'm not talking about keeping Jahai on life support indefinitely, but I'm talking about offering compassionate communication, apologizing for any adverse medical events that happened. In this case, I don't know if there was a medical error or not, but regardless, an apology goes a long way towards bridging the gap of trust between patient and hospital, between family and hospital. And I just wish that on the day that the patient was declared brain dead, that they also hadn't issued a statement saying that the patient was a corpse and going to the morgue. To me, that smacks of cold communication and a real lost opportunity to help this family go through the anger and the frustration and the sadness and, for, to put a word on it, the grief of losing their daughter.
Our phone lines are open. We welcome phone calls. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. If you've got an observation, a question, a comment about brain death in our modern society and what's happening with these cases, we want to hear from you, 614-8980. Colin has called in. Colin, thanks for calling in. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I did two tours in Iraq with medical units, and they had very specific criteria for being able to declare time of death or that an individual had actually become deceased. It couldn't be done by a medic or by a registered nurse or a physician's assistant, and even not by certain types of doctors who are not credentialed for certain things in theater. And not to make light or take away from anyone's tragedy, but sometimes lead to these farcical situations whereby all accounts of logic and medicine, the individual would be deceased, but could not be deceased until the Army had told them they had permission to be so. And given some of the comments and what they've said about doctors being a little bit cagey about brain death, do you think this will eventually evolve to a point where there's a separate credential or specialty where only a certain type of doctor who is properly trained will be able to declare anyone deceased, regardless of the condition they arrive at a facility in?
All right, Colin, thanks for that great call. Appreciate that. So, Dr. Garvin, can you kind of address that and also explain for us what is the rigor of being able to examine someone and determine that they are actually brain dead?
Yeah, and I think that that's a good question about do you need to have a certain credentials. And for the most part, in most hospitals, if there's someone with a neurologic background, such as a neurologist, a neurosurgeon, or someone else who often sees patients with neurologic injuries, they are often trained in how to do a brain death exam. Is there going to be any kind of standardization? I think at first the medical community itself needs to come together and decide, what exactly is going to be done for these brain death exams? Because as of now, it's very hospital specific that the American Academy of Neurology has put out guidelines in that these are how you do the tests, and then these are ancillary or other tests that you can do to support your clinical diagnosis, as brain death is a clinical diagnosis. But hospitals have different policies and different states that some states say that two physicians need to do a brain death exam just once in terms of a clinical
exam. Well, what goes into
the
exam? How
sure.
do they do that?
So there are several aspects that go into the exam. First of all, before you even do an exam, you need to make sure that there is nothing that's reversible. Is there anything that is causing the patient to look like they are brain dead, such as certain drugs, certain toxins, patients who come in whose body temperatures may be very low? These are all things that can make somebody look as if they're brain dead. So there's a checklist of things that need to be gone through before you can even go into an exam. Once you go to do a brain death exam, there are three parts of it. Number one is making sure the patient is unresponsive to any stimuli.
Let me say, this is a non-invasive exam, right?
Correct.
It or is just observation.
It is a completely clinical exam. So you check to make sure the patient is unresponsive to stimuli, so clapping your hand, shouting at them, looking for any signs of responsiveness, eye opening, or movement. And then there's the part of the cranial nerve exam, and this is the nerves that come off of the brainstem, and it's very specific in that the patient has to be in a certain position for parts of the exam, that the patient has to be watched very carefully for some parts of the exam for a full minute, so you're watching for any changes. So each of those cranial nerves are gone through specifically for certain tests to look for function. And then the third part of the test is what's called an apnea test, and that's looking to see if a patient has a response of breathing for the carbon dioxide levels in the blood to rise, because that changes the acidity of the blood.
But you're describing a very, you know, structured and complex and comprehensive examination of an individual. This is not something to just stick their head in the door and say, yep, he's not there. So
correct.
This is something that is understood, universally pretty much understood about how to do this.
Yes.
Okay, all right, we're going to take a quick break, but I want to talk when we come back about this locked-in fear or that this locked people who are or say they're there, they're conscious, they just can't move anything to show you that they're there. How do we know that's not happening? We're going to take a quick break. We want to hear from callers. The number is 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about brain death, and we're joined by Jason Morrow, medical ethicist of palliative physician at the UT Health Science Center, and a neurointensivist, Rachel Garvin, also from UT Health Science Center. And Jason, you wanted to comment on the last question.
Right. Colin, I wanted to thank you for your service, and I wanted to add that to Dr. Garvin's observation, you know, when you see somebody die, And not to be too grim, but there are cases where it's painfully obvious. If someone is decapitated or if they're exsanguinated, they lost all their blood, if rigor mortis has set in, I don't think we should debate whether or not they're dead. But I think what we should do, as the case of being on a tour of duty in Iraq and witnessing death might highlight, there's a difference between physiologic death and social death. And I think that's part of the complexity of what we're dealing with. Death is not just the extermination of a flame. It is a social experience. There are rituals involved. So I'll have patients that I'm caring for who do meet the criteria of brain death and are dead. But as far as the family is concerned, they may not be able to agree. For example, I've cared for people, and I'm sure Dr. Garvin has as well, where family is coming in from out of town. And it's important to respect the ritual of saying goodbye, of laying eyes on somebody and believing it for yourself. Death itself is the end of a process of dying. Dying itself is part of living. That's part of the cultural difficulty we have in accepting that dying is a part of life. But I think it's not inconsistent, and it's not, you know, a joke on military intelligence to say that a person may be dead, but we will wait to declare them dead in the terms that the military needs socially so that they can then get benefits and receive other treatments.
So, Dr. Garvin, let me ask you about locked in. What is that?
So there's a certain type of stroke that can happen in part of the brainstem that can make people almost appear from the outside like they may be brain dead. Patients aren't able to move. The only function they have is really of some eye movement. But again, going back to, you know, that someone's fear that they may be pronounced brain dead when they have a certain type of stroke, that's why these exams are so specific. So in these patients, if you were to do an exam on them, you would see that they have eye movement. If you were to hook them up to a machine that looks at brain waves, their brain waves would not be flat like you would see in a brain dead patient. If you did a blood flow study to look at blood flow to the brain, you would see that the patient has blood flow to the brain. So there are many situations where patients can appear as they do not have brain function, but that's why we're so specific in these criteria of making sure that nothing is missed when doing these evaluations. And we really try to explain that when I work with patients and families. I take a lot of time explaining to the family exactly what we're doing and the time frame and what that means if the test shows that the patient is brain dead.
In the Texas case of Ms. Munoz, she's been declared brain dead, but she's also pregnant. And that's why the hospital says they can't take her off of life support because there's a state law that says they can't do that. the unborn child is only 12, 14 weeks old and is not considered sustainable. So some people are saying that this could be a constitutional challenge, that that allowing this woman, even though she has specifically expressed that she did not want to be kept on life support and be maintained this way. So, Jason, this is full of complications.
Oh, this is as complicated as it gets. So my understanding, again, based on the same reports that the listening public can find, is that Marlise was found collapsed on the floor in her kitchen late November, something like that. This was attributed to a pulmonary embolism, blood clot going to the lung, depriving her of blood flow to the brain. At that time, she was 14 weeks pregnant. My understanding is now she's about 21 weeks pregnant. The Texas Health Code includes the Texas Advanced Directive Act and articulates the standards of death, and also in recent years has added language describing what can and cannot be done with regard to life support for people who are pregnant. There, I believe, is consensus in the medical ethics community about what the hospital is doing. This is a county hospital, so I'm a little surprised at the approach they've taken. They're interpreting the Texas Health Code, which states that life support cannot be removed from a pregnant patient. They're interpreting that as meaning that because Ms. Marlise Munoz is pregnant, that life support cannot be removed. However, another part of the health code articulates exactly what Dr. Garvin and I were describing earlier about the definition of death, including brain death. Marlise Munoz has been determined to be brain dead, and by that token, she is not a patient any longer. She is formerly a patient. And for that reason, they are not obligated to continue life support because she is pregnant, but she is not a living person. Very complicated. It's even hard for me to say and wrap my mind around. But when you think about it, what we're talking about ultimately is the integrative functioning of the human body. A human cell can live. A tree can live. A whole person can exist and flourish. But her body is being maintained. It's being oxygenated through artificial means. If you stop them, then if you stop the machines, the rest of her body will give way.
But there are a lot of people who are on machines, and they live off, and they depend on machines, you know, whether it's dialysis or whatever. I mean, it's not the machines that's the issue. It's the lack of brain activity, right?
Well, the machines are sort of fooling us into making us think that she is a person who is living, who has a brainstem that's driving her circulatory and pulmonary function. But it's not. It's an electrical plug in a machine that's driving her lung and heartbeat.
Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. But what do we know about the unborn child and their condition that this can they actually give birth to a fully functional,
well, this,
normal?
The Marlise Munoz, as I understand it, the fetus has a heartbeat. I'll speculate that it's very likely that the baby has also suffered anoxic brain injury associated with the injury with the mother. So what we don't know is, will this fetus be viable at delivery? And there's a wrinkle here. If Marlise Munoz is 21 weeks pregnant, and the county judge sort of drags his heels in taking this to court, then it might be that the fetus will cross the threshold of viability and can be delivered by C-section, at which point, according to the hospital's logic, they would allow withdrawal of life support as requested by the patient's husband or the former patient's husband.
Well, what about even now in Texas, we have that 20-week law that you can't have an abortion after 20 weeks, right?
Well, I mean, yes, you're right. And if the husband went and unplugged the machine right now, the penal code might be invoked and say that he caused the death of an individual, which the Texas Health Code describes an individual. Again, we're talking about individuals, persons, patients. It's difficult language, but the penal code articulates an individual, including anybody, after the time of fertilization. So he might be criminally liable, but this goes to the point you made just a moment ago. If the baby has suffered irreversible brain damage and would not be viable on its own, then the prosecutors probably would never be able to prove that removing life support from the mother caused the death of the fetus or the baby.
But the husband has medical power of attorney, and also the woman's parents are in sync with the husband that they do want her taken off of life support. So basically the whole family, you're not having this infighting in the family like you had with Terry Schiavo. This is, they are saying take her off life support even with the pregnancy issue.
You know, we see cases of wrongful death, and this would be a case of wrongful life support. The family might argue that what the hospital is doing is aggravated. It's battery. It's some sort of assault to the body of Ms. Munoz.
So, Dr. Garvin, I mean, is this making your job harder when you've got to deal with people and decide what their conditions are? Are you having to weigh more issues that may be outside of the examination room?
Yeah, I think it's always going to be difficult because the general public just doesn't have the same medical knowledge as we do as medical providers. And I think our job is just to make sure to communicate and educate. And that's a big part of what I do when I deal with patients that are progressing to brain death that I know that we're likely going to have to do these exams on. And it just requires a lot of time and comforting of the patient, of the families, and really doing a lot of explaining and explaining the difference between coma and vegetative state and brain death. And when brain death is declared, what does that mean? And I think it can make it difficult when we have these cases that may in some ways put some distrust of the general public of medical providers, of a fear of I may be pronounced brain dead when I'm not brain dead. But I think that education just needs to be out there that this is something that medical providers take very seriously and that we just need to educate families as to what's involved in that. If someone is pronounced brain dead, then they are dead.
Let's go to the phones really quick. John has called in. John, thanks for calling into The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. My question is if the hospital recognizes that a pregnant woman should not be taken off life support, am I understanding that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. Does that that says a lot to me that the state recognizes that there's life growing in that woman. And whether she's brain dead or not, if the infant or the zygote or whatever it is continues to grow, I think then, you know, they should allow this infant to come into the world just because they can. I mean, just because we can do it.
Okay. John, thanks for calling in. We're out of time. I wish I could give you more time, but I can't. I'm out of time. All right. So any reaction at all? I mean, John's expressing a very emotional and a valid point of view.
It's extremely complicated. And I guess if I have time to add that the most important thing hospitals need to be taking from these cases is to really embrace families and offer them supportive care, palliative care services, good communication amongst physicians and families, and earning their trust by accommodating their grief and responding appropriately is utmost importance.
All right. We're out of time. Thank you so much. That was Jason Morrow, medical ethicist, palliative physician, UT Health Science Center, also joined this afternoon by neurointensive Dr. Rachel Gavin, Garvin, also with the UT Health Science Center. This is The Source on KSTX.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.